KBOO.FM on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Mobilizing Local Culture, a University of Oregon Arts Management Workshop in Portland, June 23rd through the 28th, showcasing the ways in which local culture mobilized to make a difference in neighborhoods across the city. More info at aad.uoregon.edu/summer-intensive.
Like to take a cement fix, be a standing cinema, dress my friends up just for show, see them as they really are. But the people in my brain, too new pens to have a go. I'd like to be a gallery, put you all inside my show. Andy Warhol looks a scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all.
I'm Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Radio, Portland. My guests this week are Scott Fife and Fred Shaning. Scott is the scenic designer for Portland Center Stage's current production of Othello, and Fred Shaning is the technical director at Portland Center Stage. Welcome to KBOO.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So this Othello is one of the biggest Shakespeare plays you could see in Portland. There's a kind of scale of production you would go down to Ashland for. And Scott, you designed the set, and the idea of the set is it's a sort of rotating cube with M.C. Escher-like qualities. So could you just say about how that set looks as you sit in the theater?
Yeah, the idea is, as a set, it should put us in place, tell us where we are. But with the director's help, we decided that we wanted movement on the set and to help us change location. And unlike a lot of Shakespearean sets, this one is set on a revolve, so we can see different aspects of the set. And the idea of M.C. Escher came up early on in a concept meeting. The director wanted a set where he could have characters hide in shadows and be eavesdropping from, say, an upper level, and then walk down a staircase and be part of a conversation. M.C. Escher came up mainly because of his famous 1960 painting of Ascending and Descending, which is basically a cube-like structure of basically a staircase to nowhere. It goes up, it goes down, and no matter how much you stare at it, you can't tell where it begins and where it ends. And that is something I tried to portray in this set.
And the director, Chris Coleman, so you had a meeting all together, and he was saying, this is how I want it to look. This is the concept.
Yeah, so all of us meet, myself, the sound designer, lighting designer, costume designer, the director, production manager. We all meet, and we all have read the script intensely. We've done all of our research. We all have general ideas of what we think the play should be. But ultimately, it comes down to the director. And it wasn't till we all gave our input that the director told us, you know, this is how he envisions it. And his vision was to play it straight, to play it in period, just to tell the story as it was written. And that really excited me, because I really enjoy that time period as a setting. It's very beautiful, especially in Venice and Cyprus. So that was very exciting for me to be able to put a set, a Venetian set from Cyprus, on stage. The next challenge for me was to help tell the story that we start in Venice and we go to Cyprus, which is no easy task. especially with really what we decided would be a unit set, meaning one set to tell both tales.
Mm-hmm. So a unit set is, they're not things coming down from the flies or things rolling off left and right. It's
right.
Just one thing that rotates or
right.
moves.
Right. We decided early on that it would just be one central set, and that in different configurations would create settings to tell this tale. So my job was to make this unit set, as it turns around, look as different as I could from every angle to help relay that to the audience that mm-hmm. we're now in a different location. And that's where lighting takes place as well. Lighting indicates day, night, but also it can indicate cool or warm. So in Venice, we decided it would be nighttime and cool, very, very shadowy. And then once we went to Cyprus, we would indicate the heat and the light to help transport us across the Mediterranean. Mm-hmm. We also have a thunder and lightning storm to help indicate a sense of travel.
So, Fred, as technical director, you are like the general contractor. You get the plans and you have to build this thing.
Yeah, Scott comes up with the picture of what the whole thing should look like, and it's my job to figure out how to build it and transform that vision into reality.
Mm-hmm. How does it come to you? Pencil sketches or 3D modeling?
Scott drew us a lovely 3D CAD drawing, and that's what he emailed to us. Mm-hmm. And so we start, we looked at that and started pulling that apart and figuring out, first we had to figure out what it would cost in terms of labor hours and money for materials. Mm-hmm. And there was a bit of back and forth about what we could and couldn't afford. Mm-hmm. And then once we settled into what the design was actually going to be, then it was time to start, figuring out, okay, how am I going to separate this set into different chunks that we can actually transport, because we have a shop that isn't at the theater. It's mm-hmm. out on Front Avenue. So we have to truck it all downtown. So it all has to fit through doors and into a truck and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So
is the armory, doesn't the armory have pretty good access?
Yeah, it does. It's got a loading dock that we share with the hotel right next door. So mm-hmm. we've got some nice big garage doors that fit in. So generally my limitation is what fits into the truck. Mm-hmm. But still, we can't fit an entire set into the truck in one big piece. So we have to figure out how that's going to come apart.
What are the kind of budget busters then when you were building this? And what were the things you had to turn down because it was, too expensive?
Well, we initially had to turn down about 2/3 of the original design.
I went a little overboard.
The initial, it was beautiful. It was lovely. And
was
we
it,
all
was
fell
it too
in love
complex?
With it. It was just too big.
It was just too much, yeah.
There was a whole lot of stuff. And
quite honestly, I think the cuts that were made were very, very wise in retrospect, in that I think the original set would have been far too distracting. It's much simpler now and tells the story better. So, mm-hmm.
but it's a little more open, too.
It's much more open, and there's a lot of positives that came out of, about a month worth of back and forth, mainly due to cost restrictions and that sort mm-hmm. of thing.
So you're up in Redmond, Washington, where you live. Sending what program were you making this CAD in?
It's an AutoCAD program, so it's a design program that architects use primarily mm-hmm. and engineers. Lots of scenic designers over the past 10 or 15 years have started using it, especially the 3D rendering aspect. So This particular set is like a giant sculpture on stage. So I was able to draft it in three dimensions, and Fred is able to look at it in three dimensions. He can spin it around on his computer and look at it from top, bottom, side, pull it apart into different pieces. It's a great, great program for a designer to present his material to a technical director.
Mm-hmm. And Fred, do you look at the CAD and it doesn't specify what materials everything is, right? It's just...
Usually no. Usually right. That's left up to me. Is
so you're going to decide is steel or wood or whatever.
Exactly, exactly.
Right. And what is this one made of primarily?
This one's primarily wood. And that was a conscious choice because wood's a little easier for our shop to work with. It's less expensive and it takes less time. There are, you know, many situations in which steel is better or for, you know, a variety of reasons, but this one lent itself well to wood.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Fred, how long did it take to make the set?
We usually have 4 weeks to build a set. And this one certainly took all of that, and then some. We ended up using little bits of time stolen from other builds here and there to fill in, you know, the remaining pieces. But what really helped us a lot was that we were able to job out some of the materials.
What does that mean?
In this case, what it means is a lot of the shapes in the set that Scott designed were, you know, very similar, like all the archways and stuff were the same shape. So we actually sent out a lot of materials, and that being like plywood and Luon and stuff, to a local shop that has a CNC router. Like a computer-controlled router, and they cut all those pieces out for us. We were able to send them a CAD drawing and all the materials, and they cut it all out for us, and then, you know, we brought it back and just assembled it. So we did it mm-hmm. a little bit more assembly line than we usually do, but that helped us a lot in terms of cutting down on the amount of time it took to build this set.
Is set building generally quicker than 50 years ago because of all this technology? Or could this thing have been built in 4 weeks, you know, in 1970?
It's hard to say. Every shop is different. But in general, I think you probably wouldn't have had a set quite this physical and detailed. I think in the past, you ended up with a lot more sets that were sort of wing and drop type things with a lot of painted soft goods and smaller physical sets. Designers recently seem to be more in favor of very realistic sets instead of more fantastical. So that takes a little more time in terms of getting all the textures and the hardware and all that stuff exactly right.
So there was a musical in the West End like 30 years ago, Metropolis, based on the famous movie.
Okay.
And it had a very elaborate set, machinery and factory stuff. Mm-hmm. And people joked that, you know, it's a musical where you come out whistling the set. It was not a very good musical, but you went for that. And that, how do you, you're dealing with Othello and you're trying not to get in the way of the story. So, Scott, how do you... control what you're doing and make it serve the play?
Well, that's a good question. I think that's where the set designer and the director sit down and talk and make sure the scenic elements that are there are useful. So they're not just simply there. There's a reason for it, and that then helps tell the story. This is a two-level set, and the director is using the levels really wisely in that, you know, Othello, there's so much backstabbing, literally backstabbing and eavesdropping and people lurking in the shadows. And this set is all about giving the director spaces to facilitate that. And he's done that really brilliantly. And it's just so nice for me to see when the actors hit the stage in costume and see the set come to life and see all of this that I've had in my head for so long, you know, mm-hmm. come to be. It's really, really quite magical.
And your research began with Caravaggio, correct?
Yeah. Caravaggio is an Italian painter who lived the same time as Shakespeare. And, you know, in your research, 17th century, you can't look at photographs or anything, so you have to go to paintings for research. And this particular person really struck me because of his deep shadow, dark brooding style. Largely a portrait painter, but his landscapes have that same sort of intensity, and also give me architectural reference as to what, you know, what simply what the buildings look like. What really intrigued me about Caravaggio is his background. He could have been in Othello. He murdered two people in his lifetime. He was jailed and escaped, and died at 39 from lead poisoning. So just tragic story. So that even more made me want to sort of portray his work on stage. And then the Escher part was to help with the perception of this unit set changing depth and character just by rotating, which is something that Escher is famous for, is his how he can twist perception to fool the eye. And that's something, again, I tried to do with this set, sort of becomes foreground and background just by turning around.
And so those is that you or the director's idea of like showing what Iago's doing, twisting and deceiving?
Is
that literal?
Well, when I read the script, which is of course the first thing you do, that's how I saw it in my head. You know, that this guy is very deceptive, cunning, smart, and right away I you know, but when I read the script, I didn't know what the director had in mind. He could have put it on a playground for all I knew, you know, so I just have to go with my gut.
My name is Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Radio. My guests this week are Scott Fife and Fred Shaning. They are the scenic designer and technical director for the current show Othello, which is at Portland Center Stage through May the 11th. Fred, the set moves a lot. So what is the challenge of actually building something that is safe and does all these, you know, has all these moving parts?
Well, certainly you want it to be reliable and repeatable, because the actors have to, you don't want them to have to adjust their blocking every night. You should be able to do the same motions every time. So you want to make sure the turntable goes to the same places every time. And we have a computer-controlled system that will do that. Another challenge is that you don't want the set to wobble. So it has to be very sturdy. Because if you build something that looks like stone, but it shakes when it moves, that's not, you know, going to be very believable. So you want to make sure it's a good, solid structure. And, you know, also for the safety of the actors, because, you know, you don't want a set that falls over or anything like that. You know, that'd be terrible. So you want to build it primarily, you know, your first concern is safety. You know, your next concern is that it's good and sturdy so that it looks believable. And then, you know, repeatable. So
We're going to listen to a bit of music that you've brought in. Something you listen to when you're working. You've brought in the band is Juno Reactor, and we're going to hear Mona Lisa Overdrive from the album Labyrinth.
My musical tastes are kind of all over the map, but when I'm working, I'm doing a lot of working with spreadsheets or working in, you know, drafting in AutoCAD. So I like a lot of music that's energetic, but doesn't require a lot of concentration. So I've been listening to a lot of, you know, electronica and industrial music and things like that. Coupled with the fact that I've recently started doing the whole standing desk thing, it kind of helped me bounce around a little bit and keep active, but, you know, allows me to concentrate on my drafting and still be
active. I just imagined you in a workshop with, like, angle grinders and nail guns and stuff.
My office
is just part of it,
next to the shop. So it helps to have music that's not particularly soft, because the noise does bleed through.
Scott, what's your background? How would someone who's an artist get into this very specific thing? You're a sculptor and you're passionate about painting and you're making these sets. So just tell us a little bit of background.
What I should have done is gone to school for a scenic design, but I went to school for sculpture and painting, a fine arts degree.
Mm-hmm. Where was that?
In SUNY New Paltz. It's a little small upstate art school in New York. My dream was to become a painter, just show in galleries and painter/sculptor. When I realized that dream is almost impossible to achieve, I started working for various artists and then just sort of fell into working with a director who needed some scenery. But my work here at Portland has just been awesome. People are great. And Fred is very humble, but what he did on that stage is really quite remarkable. And I think his biggest feat is that the Revolve doesn't make any noise. That is amazing.
Yeah.
What is it like working with, you know, this one of the greatest plays ever, Othello, you know, this Shakespeare? I would imagine it's like you'd have to bring your A game, you know. It's not a musical. Does it feel any different for either of you?
For me, no, because I mean, we try to always bring our A game, you know, whether it's a new play or an old play or the scenery is sort of a character in the play. And if you do it, it's a little bit like editing. If you do it well, you don't notice that it's not, you know, jumping out at you. It can be a really great, spectacular set, but you don't want it to necessarily outshine the actors. You want it to be part of the whole vision. If you're pulling, if it's so remarkable that it's pulling the audience out of that world, then, you know, you haven't really succeeded. You want it to be part of a seamless picture that kind of draws the audience in and gets them into the world of the play.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we're really all about.
And I think, you know, the part of going to see Shakespeare is you've seen it so many times. You've seen Hamlet so many times. A big part of going is, oh, how are they doing it this time? You know, is it Nazi Germany again? Or
Exactly. What?
So you have to entertain on that level of, like, wow, people are going to remember this for the rest of their lives, how it was done.
Mm-hmm.
They remember the actor, you know, the actor's famous, that kind of thing. Scott, when you take your design and then you add the actors and the costumes, how did that change what you did, or I guess you planned it, you know, it was all planned?
It's all planned, but it brings it to life, you know. Even though the set moves, it's still static. It doesn't say anything, it doesn't do anything. But once you put the actors on the set, then all of a sudden, like Fred was saying, it becomes a character. It helps tell the story. But that doesn't happen without costumes and lighting and a great director.
And what's the idea of the costumes? I mean, the buildings look kind of stone-like, and what about the costumes?
The costumes are period as well. The set itself is, stone and stucco, cool colors, whereas the costumes have more of a nice, brilliant sheen to them. They really pop nicely on the set, so the second take, though it's massive, it can take sort of a back seat, which is good. You always want the actors to shine. So the costumes are helping do that, and they're absolutely stunningly beautiful costumes, very, very ornate, and they just play very, very well off the backdrop of the set.
Fred, what happens to this set afterwards? Do you sell it, rent it out, take it apart?
Usually it goes in the dumpster. which, you know, it's a bummer, but that's just the reality of building scenery in theater. You always have another one coming down the pipe.
So, Scott, this is all very much, you know, the Doge era Venice, and that is, if people want to see the kind of paintings you were looking at, or the reference material, they could go to the Portland Art Museum, which has a show on right now about Venice in the time of the Doges. Just tell us a little bit about your research. Like, where did you go? Which paintings? Did you go see them? You know, did you go see paintings live, or was it all?
Well, luckily, I travel a lot, and I've actually been to Venice several times. So I actually looked at my own photographs first.
What kind of camera do you use?
Oh, just usually just at this point my iPhone. you know, just small. A digital camera. I'm not by any means a photographer, but I do like.
Are you on Instagram?
No.
Okay.
No. But I do, when I travel, it's also always in the back of my head research. So I take photographs of the strangest things, you know, especially when I'm at Disneyland, that kind of stuff. Aside from that, just looking at 17th century painters to get their perspective of their world that they lived in. Of which, again, Caravaggio was a big influence for this particular piece.
Did you research a painting by going to the galleries, you know, around the world, or online, or in books, or what?
I would go to the library and research particular painters and particular time frames. And then, of course, online, you can look up just about anything nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm still a stickler for a good book, a good research book.
Wasn't it your neighbor in Redmond, Washington, who believed that we'd all have big walls where we could display classic art that would change as we walked into the room? Bill Gates?
Yeah. Yeah, well, that might happen. There's talk about, you know, painting your walls the paint itself would be able to transform the wall into any painting or image you want, and just by pushing a button or who knows what.
Mm-hmm.
So that's down the road for sure, which
right.
It's going to change a lot of things. But
there is a tie-in with the Portland Art Museum's current Venice show. If you go to veniceinpdx.com, you can learn about it, and if you take your Othello stub to the museum, you can get 2-for-1 entrance to the show of Venice.
And then it was time to move here, so.
Mm-hmm. So if somebody is, would you say the type of people who do your work come out of an art background or a kind of tinkering background or some combination?
Some combination of that. I'd say largely the type of person who goes into technical direction is inclined toward the arts, but more of a like a tinkering kind of a background. Myself, I was always the kid who played with, you know, the expert builder Legos with all the gears and the structural pieces and stuff. And I've always been into playing with electronics and things like that.
I'm Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Radio Portland. My guests this week were Scott Fife and Fred Shaning. Fred Shaning is the technical director, and Scott Fife is the scenic designer for Othello. Shakespeare's Othello is on now, Portland Center Stage, through May the 11th. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you. Andy Warhol, just a scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell him apart at all.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Pete Seeger Tribute and Sing-Along on Saturday, May 3rd, from 3 to 10 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. on what would have been Pete Seeger's 95th birthday, his life and legacy will be honored with song, remembrances, and a talk by Joe Hickerson. Again, that's Saturday, May 3rd, at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO is looking for a membership director. Duties include database management, conducting mailings, producing reports, assisting members managing pledge drives, and of course, working closely with other staff members here at the station. The ability to work with numerous people in a fast-paced environment is essential. This is a mix of part-time and full-time work, with 40 hours per week being required leading up to, during, and following each membership drive. A full benefit package is included. KBOO is an equal opportunity employer and affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. Our organization does not discriminate on the basis of age, race, religion, color, sex, national origin, marital status, sexual orientation, class, creed, physical or mental disability. For a more detailed job description and printable job application, go to kboo.fm, search for hiring, H-I-R-I-N-G. And to apply, please send a resume via email to hiring, H-I-R-I-N-G, at kboo.org. The application deadline is 5 p.m. on Wednesday, April 30th, 2014.
And now for the KBOO News at Noon. Today, Tuesday, April 29th, is the last day to register to vote for the primary election coming up on May 20th. There are two ways to register if you've been procrastinating. You can sign up online.